The following podcast contains explicit language.
I want to tell you my secret now. I see dead people.
Silent Green is people!
Leave my sister and my daughter!
Rosebud.
What's in the box?
Hello, and welcome to another Slate Spoiler Special. I'm Forrest Wickman, Slate's culture editor, and today we're spoiling Deadpool 2. Here to talk with me about the film, our Slate editorial assistant, Marissa Martinelli. Hey, Marissa.
Hey, Forrest.
It's completely ridiculous that we're saying hey, considering we've seen each other like 10 times already today. Right. Well, I'm trying to start doing the fourth wall breaking right off the top here. Also joining us, not in the studio, is Slate Browbeat editor Sam Adams. Hey, Sam.
Hello.
So Marissa and I saw Deadpool 2 last night. Sam, you saw it last week, I think.
That's right.
And are working on your review now. I think we should start the usual way, which is by each giving a thumbs up or a thumbs down. I think we should also talk about our briefly, like, do a thumbs up, thumbs down for the original movie as well, so we can compare and contrast a little bit. Marissa, how about you?
I would give the original Deadpool a definite thumbs up, and I would give this one a slightly more half-hearted thumbs up, but still pointing up.
But still pointed northward. Okay, Sam?
I guess I would give them sort of both a thumb sideways and slightly downward trend. But yeah, I think I'm certainly, if you like the original one, you like this one. I think your life will be nonetheless if you skip it. But, you know, it's Ryan Reynolds is trying very hard to be likable, and he is likable.
Yeah, I guess, I mean, I somewhat regret that we could not find a single Deadpool super fan for this spoiler special, but I think that no such person exists on the Slate culture staff. I enjoyed the first movie. I think it felt a little more fresh than doing many of the same things all over again the second time. I would give this movie probably a thumb sideways, definitely in quotation marks, which is supposed to make everything funnier, I guess. I think it just, like, the more this movie seems increasingly pleased with itself. Like, it talks a lot about how well the how well the first movie did in terms of box office, whereas the first movie, it seemed to at least be like more sincerely self-deprecating, and now it seems higher and higher on its own supply. I don't know if you guys also got that feeling.
Yeah, I agree that there was a very smug tone to the movie, more so than in the first one, but I felt like it was earned. At least it wouldn't work to be self-deprecating again, and I think that was the right move in terms of going meta.
Yeah, I agree that they couldn't pretend like the first movie didn't make $750 million or whatever it made. All right, so we should get into spoiling. Who can start us off with where this movie begins? Sam, how about you?
Well, let us begin by spoiling the first scene in the movie, which involves the death of Deadpool's lady love, Vanessa, played by Mirena Baccarin. One of the things that gave the first movie heart, or quote-unquote heart, since everything in these movies is kind of between several layers of parentheses and quotes and winky-winky meta fourth wall breaking. This one opens with, the first scene is Deadpool blowing himself up, and then we rewind slightly to find out why he's doing that, and it turns out that these thugs kind of, you know, break into their house to get revenge for him screwing up one of their criminal schemes, and a stray bullet kills her. So that knocks her out of it, and then the opening credits are basically similar to the opening credits in the first movie. They're basically like, what the fuck did you just do? Did you just kill her? So one thing this movie does a lot is do things that are extremely not transgressive and then act as if they're transgressive and they've just done something extremely daring. So the movie basically begins in the most obvious place by killing off the woman that they paired him up with at the beginning of the previous movie, you know, really fridging her to just give his character something to do in this movie, and then acting like, oh, shit, did we really just do that? So that's where it begins.
Yeah, to me it felt kind of unclear whether they were acting like killing her was a sincerely shocking thing to do. You know, you mentioned that it says produced by Did You Just Kill Her? Or whether they were saying kind of the opposite, that it is the most cliche thing that you can do. A couple other of the credits say, quote, written by the real villains and directed by one of the guys who killed the dog from John Wick, which was funny. I guess we should say this movie is directed by David Leitch, who is indeed one of the guys who killed the dog from John Wick. I think a lot of the jokes in this movie, whenever it tries to be more subversive, it's actually very much up to interpretation, whether that is a joke about fridging or just a joke about, OMG, I can't believe they just killed the love interest.
I had the same interpretation as Forrest. I absolutely took it as a dig at other superhero movies that do fridge their female characters for reasons that we'll get into later in the spoiler special, just with how the character's death is treated. But I did laugh during the opening credits because I think the first one is like a film by, wait a minute. And that's exactly what my thought process was like. So it was kind of fun to see that on screen.
Yeah, it was fun to hear that.
I think there is that. I mean, there's that sort of meta quality to like everything in the movie and meta layers of it. I mean, but it is also like factually what they're doing. Like they're, you know, taking this, you know, female character and I don't know, maybe Miranda Baccarin didn't feel like doing too much in the sequel, but they are still like killing her off to get her out of the way so that they can kind of, you know, protect whatever character arc they had in mind for him. So the fact that it's a joke about it maybe doesn't mean that they're also not doing it. That's one of the, you can really talk yourself in circles with this movie, which is part of the enjoyability of it, but also kind of the frustratingness of it. Like, it's just everything is so arch and self-conscious and so arch and self-conscious about being so arch and self-conscious.
Yeah, I mean, it just seems to think that we shouldn't spend too much time on this, but it just seems to, this seems like a perfect example to me of how this movie seems to think that quotation marks and self-consciousness save everything. So you can do pretty much all of the same things that every other superhero movie does, and you can kind of critique them and put them in quotation marks, and that's supposed to somehow excuse the fact that you're literally just doing the same thing. Anyway, it is occasionally clever. So one part that we didn't mention is Deadpool's declaration that this is a family movie, which I think plays out a couple different ways. Marissa, maybe you could walk us through that.
So we zip past the opening scene where Deadpool blows himself up, but there are quite a few references to Logan, the Wolverine film from last year. And of course, Wolverine is sort of the butt of a lot of jokes in both the original Deadpool and the new Deadpool.
Right. I believe the first line is fuck Wolverine. And then he says, I'm dying in this one, too. And he talks about how Logan kind of stole their steez when it came to doing an R-rated superhero film.
And he pulls out a little Logan, you know, Wolverine figurine where he's impaled, which is how, spoiler alert, that's how Logan ends. But I really liked in the beginning that they laid out sort of the two main themes of the movie, which is that the superhero is going to die and that it's going to be a family film because Logan turned out to be a family film. And so the way that plays out is that after Vanessa dies, Deadpool turns to the X-Men and specifically to Colossus. And is sort of welcomed into the fold, even though all he wants to do is die so that he can join Vanessa, which he can't do because he has regenerative powers. So he's brought into the X-Men and he finally seems to be embracing, you know, having a family, thanks to some very vague advice from sort of a dream version of Vanessa, with whom he wanted to start a family before she was killed. But his first mission with the X-Men does not go so smoothly.
Right. Well, and this is where he gets the, like, instead of getting an actual biological child of his own, he attempts to save this character named Russell, who I think was both one of the better parts of this movie and also just a complete 100% lift from The Hunt for the Wilder People. Did either of you guys see that movie?
Yeah, that was great. Yeah, this is Julian Dennison, who is a young New Zealand actor who was in Hunt for the Wilder People and has been showing up in a couple of other things. He's just a really, really funny, hilarious young actor playing a sort of, you know, darker, angrier role in this movie. It's
but it's like almost exactly the same character. I mean, he's an orphan once again who cannot find a new home, and it's so similar that it goes down to the fact that he once again is a huge Tupac fan who keeps making Tupac references, which is one of the most recurring jokes in Hunt for the Wilder People. I can't say I was like especially mad about it. It just seemed a little lazy. I mean, one of the other lines in this movie is when Ryan Reynolds, at some point, it's in the trailer, he turns to the camera and he says, well, that's just lazy writing. And this movie just seems to think that declaring that its writing is lazy is enough to excuse lazy writing, which it's not.
Yeah, we should mention also this is another sort of second degree superhero connection, but Hunt for the Wilder People was also the movie that Taika Waititi directed right before doing Thor Ragnarok.
Yeah, everyone should go see Hunt for the Wilder People. So what happens next? Saving Russell does not go.
Well, we should mention that Russell is a young mutant,
right,
whose power is, he wants to be called, what is it, Fire Fist?
Yes, yep.
An extremely on-the-nose name for a superhero because his power is that he can create flames from his fists. So Deadpool is, he and Colossus and Negasonic Teenage Warhead are trying to subdue Russell, but in the process, I would be interested in what you guys thought of this scene, because Deadpool, in trying to subdue Russell, I got the sense that he was deliberately trying to get himself imprisoned along with Russell. Russell is sort of threatened by what are they called? The people who catch mutants?
Oh, I have
this
no
is
idea.
Not my wheelhouse.
Mutant just, hunters.
You
yeah,
can just say the
yeah.
people who catch mutants. That seems good enough to me.
Russell is there. They have like a scary acronym. Russell is threatened by the people who catch mutants, and he's threatened to be taken to the icebox and to have a device placed around his neck that will subdue his powers. And in the course of the confrontation, Deadpool realizes that Russell was being abused by his theoretical mutant sanctuary, and so he shoots a bunch of the caretakers, and so he is also subdued. He and Russell are both taken to the icebox, which is mutant jail. I got the sense that he did that on purpose, that it wasn't just, you know, he was enraged on behalf of this poor kid, that he, because he wants to die, decided that a collar that would mute his powers would be great for that.
Yeah, I mean, he's certainly very, I don't know if I got that quite as clearly as you did, but he's certainly very self-destructive throughout this whole period.
And we should mention too that meanwhile, while this is going on, and this is, you know, this movie is sort of, you know, almost like comically complicated in this respect. But Cable, played by Josh Brolin, has come back from the future to kill Russell, because Russell has, in the future, become, as a result of being kind of abused and abandoned, has become this kind of very evil, destructive, murderous mutant, and has killed, you know, lots and lots of people, among them Cable's wife and child. So the arc of the movie then becomes that Deadpool has to kind of, you know, redeem Russell and stop him from going down this dark path and becoming a killer.
Right, and specifically, they have to stop him from making his first kill, which will give him like a taste for blood, and then he'll never stop killing. This movie, of course, like anticipates all of the criticisms you're going to make and makes them beforehand. So it they call Josh Brolin Thanos at some point, but I don't think they point out that like how similar this character is to Thanos in a lot of ways, and that he similarly lost his family. Like, that is his tragic backstory, and he's not trying to kill off half the population, but he's similarly kind of become dark and out for revenge because of it.
Yeah, is it extremely kind of, you know, dense and referential both to itself and to other things movie? I mean, I think it's, you know, having, when I read about Infinity War, I mean, that's, Infinity War is a movie that just is kind of ceaselessly, you know, referring to and mired in this incredibly, you know, complicated and yet not that necessarily that interesting Marvel chronology of the 16 movies that preceded it. And Deadpool is kind of that squared. I mean, there are, it's just, you know, referencing things within the universe, things without, other comic book movies, other kind of details about, you know, various, you know, studio deals and which Marvel characters can appear in which movies made by which studios, is just, It's just kind of nonstop in that respect. And I think that it can be, you can be amused by a lot of those jokes and still feel kind of eventually worn down by them in some respects.
Yeah, with Cable specifically, it was unclear to me the extent to which all of his opening scenes were supposed to be funny or not. I mean, in one of the trailers for these movies, you kind of get the same introduction of Cable that you get in this movie, except for Deadpool is constantly breaking in to like make fun of the bad CGI and stuff. And in the movie, it's played fairly straight faced. It looks like an exceptionally hacky version of the introduction of a villain, but it's not quite hacky enough to be flat out funny. I mean, nobody was laughing in our theater. And at the same time, I don't think it was supposed to be sincerely cool. I don't know what you guys made of that. Like, for example, there were all these shots that were from way down at his ankles looking way up, which is, you know, the hackiest possible way to try to make a villain look imposing and scary. But it did not appear to be either a joke or sincere.
I don't know about the initial time we see Cable, but there definitely is a contrast between Cable as a character who sort of feels like he's pulled from a different, more serious movie
right. In
these ridiculous scenarios. I mean, when he first arrives in the year to kill Russell, he sees a couple of rednecks sitting on the back of a truck with, you know, like fake rubber testicles hanging off the back. And that's definitely
truck nuts.
Funny. Truck
nuts. I believe it's the technical
really,
term.
I'm not familiar with this lexicon.
It's a thing.
But truck nuts? Okay. Cable driving a car full of truck nuts. That's funny to me.
Yeah. I mean, there is the one line where they say, I think Deadpool says, "You're so dark." It's like, are you from the DC universe or something?
Yeah.
Which is one of the funnier lines, I suppose. Sorry, I'm trying to muster more enthusiasm here. I'm clearly failing a little bit. So our heroes are in jail. The jail looks weirdly like the jail they always put Magneto in when everything is plastic. I wasn't really sure why that was the case, considering they already had the colors that reduced their powers and stuff. Maybe there are real plastic jails.
Aesthetic cohesion, maybe.
Right.
All the jails got to look the same.
We
should probably talk about like Russell and Deadpool's early relationship,
right?
Which is that Russell is determined to get his revenge on the kind of caretaker who abused him, and Deadpool is just not having it. Deadpool is ready to just let himself die of cancer, which has come back under the influence of the collar. And Russell is also very confident for a young scrappy kid in a jail full of terrifying mutants, and he starts trouble. And Deadpool advises him that he needs to befriend the toughest guy, the biggest guy in the jail, rather than antagonize them.
Yeah, and a weird thing happens here. I don't know if you guys noticed this, where we get a bit of foreshadowing that there is, quote, like a big monster, or the biggest guy of all is in the basement.
We're told that it's foreshadowing. Ryan Reynolds turns
exactly.
The camera and says, foreshadowing.
There's some classic Deadpool mugging there. And then there's this whole action sequence where Cable breaks in and tries to kill Russell. And then all of a sudden, this is where things got really muddled to me. And I suspect there was some kind of re-editing and post-production, because there's a scene right after that where we see Russell back in jail. And it's kind of unclear to me how, like, why he's just back in jail and everything's normal again. And he's like feeding the monster in the basement, who we eventually learn is Juggernaut, who will be familiar to people who know the X-Men comics and animated series and stuff. And then like a scene after that, Cable has kidnapped TJ Miller, which is something I don't think we ever see happen.
There is a scene where it goes around where TJ Miller's like coming out of the bar, kind of like the camera moves around the corner, and there's like some, he's like waiting for him. So I think it's implied that that's going to happen. We definitely don't see it actually happen, but there's a bit of a groundwork laid there.
Okay.
Don't they assemble the X-Force first and then they kidnap TJ Miller?
I think it says a lot about this movie that you guys had last night, and we're still having trouble like remembering exactly how the plot works. Yeah. That definitely happens at some point.
I'm pretty sure, because I thought it was a setup within the X-Force attack.
Wow. I mean, if that's the case, that would make a lot of sense, but that is definitely not what came across to me. But I don't think any of this is, it didn't particularly bother me because it's a movie that doesn't take itself that seriously in the first place.
Right.
Which again becomes very clear in the introduction of the X-Force. Who would like to walk us through the X-Force?
Well, there's a whole sequence in the movie where Deadpool assembles a sort of cut-rate band of superheroes, which he then decides to call X-Force, which is a name that's already taken. And
well, you know, we should say he explains that he thinks X-Men is a sexist name because they're not all men, which is both a good point, but I feel like he's kind of playing it as a joke. And like sexism and racism are always just like jokes in this movie. There's this other running thing where who is the guy who calls himself like Black Tom or something, but he's like a white guy.
His superpower, as Ryan Reynolds notes, is cultural appropriation.
Right. So he's like, you know, he's not actually black, so it's all just a joke. And meanwhile, there's like
the character of the sort of Indian cab driver who's, you know, sort of a, you know, verging on a kind of Apu-like stereotype. And then, you know, and then they, you know, they lampshade it at the end of the movie where there's some bit of voiceover where Deadpool's talking about, like, basically how to put together a Deadpool movie. And he says, oh, you include this and that. Oh, and it's just that dash of racism. And it's just like, well, admitting that your movie's kind of racist doesn't make it okay for it to be racist.
Right. If you know it's racist, maybe just don't do it.
Right. But yeah, that would be too hard. So instead they just do it and kind of, you know, they get to it before you can. Although I certainly already registered that complaint mentally by that point in the film. But yeah. Anyway, so he puts together this kind of, you know, budget X-Men. There's a whole basically, you know, Saturday Night Live type audition sequence where people come in and tell him about their powers. And he ends up, I think, hiring everybody, including this character named Peter, played by Rob Delaney, who doesn't have any powers at all. And then there is, you know, I think one of the funniest sequences in the movie where this X-Force kind of goes on their first mission. And there's a throwaway line before that about kind of a high wind advisory being a problem for this mission, which is just seems like a gag. And then they're all parachuting.
Right, because it's in the mouth of Peter. So it's just like, oh, he's just the like human without any superpowers. Get over it, Peter.
Right, but then they're all parachuting out of this plane, and in the course of parachuting out of that plane, every single one of them dies, except for Zazie Beetz's Domino. So they kind of, you know, they go into power lines, or they run into a billboard, or get hit by a bus, or
helicopter rotors, I think, might be in there.
There's a helicopter rotors. There's a wood chipper. there's having a character whose power is apparently vomiting acid, having them vomit on you, and then your body like melt away. So they all they assemble this team, which has some, you know, like very, you know, cool actors in it, like Terry Crews. And then, you know, the gag in the movie being that none of them stick around for more than, I don't know, 5 minutes.
Right. And the actors get bigger than Terry Crews. Not only is the character who I believe you described as the vomiter, the superhero whose superpower is vomiting acid and is named Zeitgeist, he's played by Bill Skarsgård, who I don't know, maybe playing the clown in It and that movie making $1 billion didn't boost his billing that much. Or it could be that he's in there just kind of as a gag, because probably the funniest bit of casting is that it turns out that the superhero named the Vanisher, who we otherwise don't see, is revealed at his death to be Marissa.
Brad Pitt. For a split second, it is literally a case of blink and you'll miss it.
Yeah, I mean,
all I can say is that don't impress me much.
I mean, it seems like he was just kind of like they almost just photoshopped his face in. Like, I'm not sure Brad Pitt actually did any. He certainly wasn't on set to the extent there even was a set for the sequence.
He did appear to be screaming in agony.
Right. I guess that's true.
I'm sure in the course of at least one of his movies, he has done that.
He was, according to the internet, at least one of the people who was, you know, in talks, whatever that means, for the role of Cable. So he had, you know, some sort of connection with the filmmakers before that. And it does seem like, you know, he has enough of a sense of humor to actually just, you know, turn up just to do a stupid, you know, one-off joke like that. But it does also, you know, that kind of speaks to the difference between this movie and the first one. And the first one was this kind of, you know, low budget, really surprise hit. I mean, people who know comics knew that Deadpool is a popular character, but nobody expected an R-rated superhero movie with just these kind of all these sort of off-brand, you know, characters. The joke, you know, the whole joke of the first movie is that you got like Negasonic, Teenage Warhead, and Colossus because like the X-Men movies don't want them because they're just lame-ass characters. And then somehow that goes and makes all this money, and then you turn up in the following movie and it's like, well, we want to get Brad Pitt for one shot, and they could do it.
Yeah, so as Sam said, one of the few surviving heroes is Domino, played by Zazie Beetz, from Atlanta, who I definitely think is one of the best parts about this movie. I don't think we've even said what her superpower is, so maybe Marissa, you can talk about her a little bit.
Oh, I love this character. I was not familiar with her as someone who's not versed in the comics, but her superpower is that she's very lucky. Which when she's auditioning, she gets pushback from Deadpool that's not a superpower, which is very funny considering Peter, who has no superpowers at all, was just accepted to the team with no problem. But she insists that being lucky is a superpower and that there's a reason that she must have ended up on this team. And she winds up being the only survivor of X-Force besides Deadpool to land on the ground. And there's this wonderful chase sequence where she gets control of the sort of armored vehicle where all the prisoners are being kept, including Russell. And just what Deadpool at one point says, you know, oh, luck is a superpower. That's not going to, you know, that's going to be hard to film or something like that. The result is
not very cinematic.
It's not very cinematic. And the result is one of the most cinematic and fun sequences where it's just a bunch of near misses or extraordinary coincidences that help her get control of this vehicle and sort of lets chance take the wheel. And it's very fun.
Yeah, I mean, it's also just a very novel superpower. I mean, this movie makes a lot of jokes about how similar many of the characters are between, for example, the DC and Marvel universes. So, for example, when Juggernaut starts running around, when he, you know, breaks out of this prison because Russell frees him, we should say. So when Juggernaut is running around and Deadpool is trying to subdue him, he does the sun is getting low, big guy thing from the Marvel Studios movies, which they always say for the Hulk, the implication being that he's kind of a similar character. And then you have like part of the joke with the Fire Fist character is that he's basically just what the Human Torch. Who is the other character who's just there's at least two other famous.
Cable is just Bucky from
there's
Winter
a lot
Soldier
of jokes
movies.
About like, oh man, another
one-armed time traveler.
Right. And so most of the time it's the usual Deadpool thing of let's do the cliche thing, but be self-conscious about it. And in the Domino character, we get something like legitimately novel and surprising and like kind of ridiculous enough that I'm not sure to what extent you might see it. And some of the you certainly wouldn't see a character like Domino in the DC movies as they have existed thus far.
Sort of car chase sequence that you're talking about earlier, Marissa. I mean, that is one of the parts in this movie where you do know that it was directed by the guy who not only killed the dog in John Wick, but did all the kind of, you know, amazing, fight sequences in that movie. There, he's became a former stunt coordinator turned director, and that is, compared to even something like, you know, Infinity War, which even though this is a much bigger budget than the first Deadpool, is probably less than half what Infinity War cost. But I mean, those, chase sequences and stuff like that are actually kind of a pleasure to watch compared to just some of the really kind of incoherent, heavily digitized action stuff in the Marvel movies.
Right. There's a funny joke later when Juggernaut and Colossus. Okay, here's another one of those characters who's very like Hulk-like, big dumb guy. He's kind of like Drax, but less funny is kind of how I feel about Colossus, but he's has his occasional charms. Anyway, when Juggernaut and Colossus are running at each other, Deadpool says something like, here comes a big CGI fight, which to the movie's credit, they don't spend too much time on the big CGI fight because they know it's like not going to be that much of a wow. It's not going to have the wow factor, really.
Yeah, this doesn't really fit in anywhere, but I just wanted to say another one of my favorite jokes in the movie is, Juggernaut is this very kind of you know, obnoxious, like, trash-talking character. He kind of had this infamous appearance in one of the X-Men movies where his, he said what had sort of become this internet meme, like, I'm the Juggernaut bitch, but then said it to a woman in the movie, and that actually came off as, like, really sexist and gross, and they just kind of took that character out of the rotation. They bring him back in this one, and he's just kind of an asshole, and he says this thing to Deadpool. He says, I'm going to rip you in half, which is the kind of thing that, like, villains say in movies, but then he actually picks up Deadpool and literally rips him in half, which I enjoyed the follow-through there.
Oh, man.
Are we going to talk about the baby legs?
Yeah, I think I repressed this part. Marissa, why don't, like, please be the person who talks about the baby legs so I don't have to.
Okay, lucky me. Well, it turns out that the process for regenerating after you've been ripped in half involves growing fresh legs, which is revealed in a sequence with Deadpool is with Blind Al, who is his kind of friend and mentor, might be a strong word.
We should
in
say
the comics.
I had forgotten that, like, almost the same bit actually does happen in the first one, and I think I just repressed it too, where he, like, loses an arm or both arms and has to regrow them, mm-hmm. and he has, like, tiny baby hands.
This is so much worse than that, though.
Well, I think one thing that's really—I don't know. One,
but I mean, he does—he regrows everything below the waist, not just his legs,
right? Which we learned
quite a few jokes about that.
Yeah, and I think probably the most tasteless joke in the movie, which is Deadpool is, like, trying to get Blind Al to hold his hand or something. I don't remember the exact setup. And then he says, that's not my hand. And in other words, like, Deadpool has just, like, essentially molested Blind Al and made her touch his penis. Which
there's there's also one where I forget exactly where, but Deadpool kind of comes face to face with a naked man's midsection and he says, Scoutmaster Kevin? I believe, and so it's like, oh, haha, a joke about children being molested by their scoutmaster. Is that funny?
I mean, part of the character is that canonically he has been molested, and it is not in terms of the filmmakers, but in terms of the character cracking a joke like that, it's very in line with, like, filtering, as Cable says, filtering your pain through humor.
Right, and in the Scoutmaster case, I think certainly one can make the case that that joke was also tasteless, but it bothered me less because at least, you know, it was Deadpool, like, punching up at the person who had offended him. Whereas in this case, right, it's literally just the hero of the movie. Granted, he's kind of an anti-hero, but the average teenager is just going to be like, oh, man, Deadpool, so awesome. Like, what great one-liners.
He got a blind woman to touch his dick, yes.
Right. And it's like, it kind of makes I think the probably the only way that the movie thinks that they can get away with this joke is because he's not, like, a fully grown man yet, and so it's sort of like touching a baby, and then therefore less sexualized.
Sure. I mean, sure that makes it that much better.
Yeah, I think it's pretty hard to. Were you guys similarly put off by that joke?
Yes, I was put off. It was, but it wasn't just Blind Al. Although that wasn't shown. That was off camera,
right?
But I mean, it's sort of the running bit throughout that whole scene that every character that enters looks down and sees, like, baby legs and a penis and is like, whoa, what's going on in here? Including Cable, who is otherwise so stoic and serious and is completely unnerved by the sight in front of him, which when it is finally revealed is as unnerving as everyone's reactions promise.
Yeah. Well, and there is a sort of extended, I think it's deliberate, this kind of extended, like, Basic Instinct reference there, where the character keeps kind of crossing and uncrossing his legs, and you keep kind of almost seeing, you know, what's between them and kind of wanting to look and not wanting to look, and definitely, like, you know, messes with you for a good long while before they,
Yeah, I mean, that part didn't, I found that part, like, I guess mostly funny. I'm certainly not, you know, generally offended by just, like, nudity and such. It's just, I mean, it's also just not very fun to criticize or be offended by this movie because it is, like, in many ways, just like a feature length troll, and Deadpool is such a troll. And so it feels a little bit like whenever you express any offense over this movie, you're kind of just playing into its, you know, tiny baby hands.
so to speak.
Right.
Tiny, weird little baby hands, yes.
So we should get to the end of the movie here.
Well, Cable and Deadpool in this scene where Deadpool's legs are tiny and he's pantsless, finally agree to team up. And Deadpool makes a deal with Cable that if he can prevent Russell from making the first kill, that sets him on this path where he will become evil and murderous. Then Cable will let Russell live. And Cable has with him sort of a charred teddy bear that belongs to his daughter because his daughter and wife were killed in the future. And so that's sort of like the Back to the Future photograph where they'll know if they change the timeline if the teddy bear is no longer charred and covered in blood.
Sam, do you want to take it from there?
Yes, and so Deadpool has his little kind of 30-second window to convince Russell to be good, and he does it eventually by successfully, because he's had the dampening collar put back on him, he actually sort of successfully manages to get himself killed by taking a bullet that's meant for someone else, and so he kind of dies at the end of the movie to save him, although there's a long sequence where you think he's dead, and then he comes back up and talks again and then dies again and then comes back up and talks again. They sort of stretch that out for, I guess one would say comic effect as well.
Yeah. I mean, I've definitely seen that bit, like the extended death take that never seems to end. I've definitely seen that bit a whole bunch of times, but that is one place where I feel like I would really give Ryan Reynolds credit for his performance and really selling that bit. I mean, maybe it was different in your theater, Sam, but that sequence kind of killed in the screening that we were in. I can't remember all the different things he says when he comes back to life. I think part of it is just that, like, I mean, I'm sure you guys knew that, of course, Deadpool's not going to die, and probably Vanessa, his girlfriend, isn't really dead either. I mean, it's hard to take any death seriously in any of these superhero movies anymore, and like a legitimately subversive thing for Deadpool to do would have been to actually kill somebody. But of course, right after that, there's kind of Chekhov's time machine, and Cable uses it to go back, redo the final sequence, and this time, he saves Deadpool. So of course, Deadpool survives.
We should note that Deadpool doesn't just take a bullet for just anyone. He takes a bullet to save Russell. And that's what kind of redeems Russell, and he realizes that he does have someone he can rely on. Because one of the things Deadpool says in coming back to life is it's one of the only sort of semi-sincere moments in the movie, is that he urges Russell to sort of go out and find his family, no matter who it winds up being.
Yeah, I found it hard to invest in any of the characters, or because the movie just doesn't take itself seriously enough. So I didn't. Were either of you moved at any point during this movie?
Not especially. I liked that because I thought it was interesting in how it paralleled with Logan. They made such a point of bringing up Logan at the beginning of the movie, and then it turned out that the plot is more or less similar in that the main character, who is a loner and who loses people who are close to him, adopts this sort of surrogate child and winds up sacrificing himself to save that surrogate child. I don't know if I found that moving as much as sort of just like an interesting ripoff / homage to a movie that,
I found myself wondering with those scenes and the scenes with Deadpool and his girlfriend, whether are the people who are making, because some of the scenes are played very straight and kind of sentimental, and I'm just thinking, like, are the people who make this movie, like, are they actually expecting people to be emotionally invested in it? I mean, are people actually getting emotionally invested in it? Like, that's kind of unimaginable to me because the rest of the movie is so kind of, arch and ironized, and it's this weird sort of, I think they want this kind of, Pavlovian, like, emotional response from you. Like, this is the moving scene, be moved. And it's just, I don't know, is anybody involved taking this thing seriously at that point? It's just, it's very weird for me. Like, I'm not sure how it's intended to play, let alone how it actually does play.
Yeah, it's definitely hard to pin down. The kind of the most obvious example of this, I suppose, is during the sequence during which Deadpool hits, quote, rock bottom, Deadpool actually, breaks the fourth wall and says there's a part in every screenplay where the character must hit rock bottom. And I found myself wondering this at a separate point, Sam, in the same way where I was looking at, I believe it was Vanessa
and she was supposed to be dead, and she still had kind of her like nightshirt on. And then I realized that they made it so that her nightshirt was kind of see-through so that you could see her like push-up bra underneath it. And like that made me think like, oh, this movie is not really taking her very seriously as a person still.
But did you know, because you, Forrest, you mentioned that you were like pretty sure Vanessa was coming back. I was not sure. I thought she was dead.
I think as soon as I realized that there was a time traveling character in this movie, I knew that any lovable character who died would be saved.
Sure. But they made such a point of saying that Cable only gets, because of lazy screenwriting, he only has two time travel jumps in him, one of which he used to go back and kill Russell, which, first of all, why didn't he come back and kill Russell as a baby? Wouldn't that have been so much easier?
Well, I think Deadpool brings this up, but I don't remember what his explanation is.
There is something like the farther he goes, the harder it is, and less exact. He couldn't go back that far. I forget whether that is only having two charges. The part where Deadpool says, "Wow, that's lazy writing," but it's definitely like one of those two. The whole time travel thing is they finesse a lot of it.
I guess I just accepted that as true, which maybe that was on me. For believing anything that this movie,
but I mean, we should talk about, while we're talking about time travel, the post credit sequence of this movie, which I think is far and away the best part of it, and it's definitely something people are going to want to stick around and watch. Maybe out of mercy, do you want to describe that?
Sure. We haven't mentioned Yukio, who is Negasonic Teenage Warhead's girlfriend in this movie.
And I think there's like basically nothing else to say about
the two
her,
of them,
right?
Really don't have much to do, but she has even less to do. She's sort of just there to be the cutesy girlfriend.
Yeah, this movie seems
to... another like running, like lampshaded running gag where all she ever says in the movie is like, "Hi, Deadpool," and he says, "Hi, Yukio." And so it's, you know, a joke about not giving this character any lines by just giving every time she has a line, it's the same line.
While also, however, for the Marvel Universe, making a very pointed way of including a gay couple in the movie, even though they are basically irrelevant to the plot.
Yeah, it seems like they kind of only appear to say, like, look, we did it.
Right.
Gay people in a Marvel movie. And then, like, they don't do anything else for the rest of the movie, which to me feels like I don't really give them many points. And also, there are, like, some pretty, I guess, at best, you might call them low-hanging fruit lesbian jokes, where, for example, when Russell shows up, he calls, what is her name? Negasonic Teenage
Warhead.
He calls her Justin Bieber, you know, playing on the whole Tumblr and running joke of lesbians who look like Justin Bieber. And that's like about as much character development and action as she gets in this movie.
Well, all this to say, in the post-credit sequence, Yukio and Negasonic Teenage Warhead fix the Cable's time-traveling device, and Deadpool uses it to go back and correct a lot of different things, including to save Vanessa, but also to go clean up the timelines, as he says, in a totally different movie, X-Men Origins Wolverine, as well as to...
Well, we should say what he does, which is that he kills off the older version of Deadpool who no one liked,
right,
basically, who was briefly introduced in that movie, but then...
Yes, and also played by Ryan Reynolds.
Right,
yes.
Right. And then from there...
And then he also kills Ryan Reynolds, who is sitting at his desk and holding a screenplay with Green Lantern written on the front, which is obviously a reference to the actual not well-received Green Lantern movies.
Right.
Likewise, had Ryan Reynolds in them. Yeah, so he's going off and kind of killing all the other Ryan Reynolds characters that he's played in various comic book movies from various studios. Yes, and that's funny both as a sort of, you know, intertextual joke, but it also is, you know, Ryan Reynolds has been kind of trying to make this happen for so long, and he's been in all these comic book movies and playing these different characters, and he has, you used the word, you know, smug at the beginning, Marissa, and you know, and I think he's a really, you know, he could be a very funny, like, charismatic, talented actor, but he has this, invariably, this kind of smug quality to the roles he plays, and why, I think the reason why Deadpool has worked so well for him is that the movie kind of, that becomes the character. Like, the smugness is kind of foregrounded, so it's no longer, it's now it's a feature, not a bug. So he's kind of finally found a character, well, that just that incredibly, like, arch, self-satisfied quality that he brings to everything is actually fits the movie for once, rather than kind of pulling you out of it.
All right, so I think I've the more I talk about Deadpool 2, maybe the less I like it. I don't know how you guys are feeling. Marissa, will you go see Deadpool 3, which will inevitably happen given that this movie is supposed to make like $300 million this first weekend?
I will go see Deadpool 3.
Sam?
I guess if I'm nothing better to do that day, I will, yes.
Yeah, I kind of feel like I have a sense of obligation to see these movies because they're so popular, but I wish I enjoyed them more than I do. All right. Please subscribe to the Slate Spoiler Special podcast feed. And if you like the show, please rate and review it in the Apple Podcast Store or wherever you get your podcasts. If you have suggestions for movies or TV shows we should spoil, or if you have any other feedback you'd like to share, please send it to spoilers@slate.com. Our producer is Daniel Schrader. For Sam and Marissa, I'm Forrest Wickman. Thanks for listening.